Don't touch that dial. More stimulating talk is coming up on News Talk K57.
And welcome back to the Data Hub. My name is Tarun Titan. I'm the Director of the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. And we're continuing with this evening's program. We're going to discuss coming up, discussing what's new with the protection of Guam's coral reefs. And then later on, we're going to discuss what assistance the Bureau is managing to secure in order to help our first responders in dealing with COVID-19. Anyone wishing to join the conversation, we can call in at 477-5757, 477-5757. We are broadcast live here on News Talk K57 and simulcast on GTA Channel 3 and Docomo Channel 2. And joining us is Mallory Morgan. Mallory, are you there? Mallory, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hello? Thanks for joining us, Mallory. Mallory Morgan is part of the Coral Reef Initiative Program, which is a grant that is managed by the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. The administrative supervision, though, of the program has been shifted over to the Department of Agriculture and the able leadership of my colleague, the Director, Chelsea Munoz-Brecht. This is part of Governor Leung-Erau's overall coral reef resiliency strategy. In order to shift the program directly in the hands of resource management agencies like the Department of Agriculture. Mallory is currently the Reef Tourism Coordinator. I believe that's your title at the moment. Right, Mallory?
Sustainable Marine Tourism.
Mallory came to us as part of a program called the Coral Fellow. This is where the federal government pays for a researcher on coral reefs. And she came to Guam here, and she was so damn good at it. We decided to keep her on to continue on to really important stuff, including sustainable tourism. And she's still involved and of course, aspects dealing with the coral reef, protection of Guam's coral reef and strengthening our response to it. And I asked her on tonight to talk about the Guam CBAM, the Guam Coral Bleaching Alert Network, which is meant to help support our efforts to protect our reefs. Before we get into that, Mallory, perhaps just give the audience a brief a sketch as to the current status of Guam's coral reefs.
Sure. So Guam's reefs are currently in a bleach watch. We are entering into coral bleaching season. So the oceans are warming, so the corals are undergoing thermal stress as it gets warmer. So the Coral Bleaching Alert Network is going to be sharing with the community as the oceans are warming over the next few months, what kind of level and what likelihood that we might see coral bleaching.
And this is of critical importance because Guam has experienced major coral bleaching events in 2013, 2014, 2016, and 2017 at a rate that is almost globally unprecedented and has caused major damage to our reef structure, including shallow coral reefs. Isn't that not the case, Mallory?
Yeah, and actually coral bleaching was first reported on Guam in 1994, and there was a few events after that, but the concern is the frequency is increasing. So as you just mentioned, we've been having back-to-back bleaching events.
And they're expected to continue to be frequent between now and the end of the century as a consequence of climate change. Is that not the case?
Exactly. So there's lots of things that can cause coral bleaching, but these mass bleaching events are from warmer ocean temperatures due to climate change.
And so part of strategies to deal with them, and it's something you've organized, is the Guam C-band. The Guam, as I said, the Guam Coral Bleaching Alert Network. Did I get the acronym right?
Okay.
So perhaps for the listeners, explain to them what is the Guam Coral Bleaching Alert Network and how does it work?
So we just launched it over the past week. And basically, the Guam Coral Bleaching Alert Network is based off of the NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Coral Reef Watch Portal. And this portal has been used by the International Coral Reef Management Community since 2000. And the portal uses satellite-derived sea surface temperature data and data from local loggers from Guam, and puts that information through climate models that predict the likelihood of bleaching. And basically, there's different alert levels based on six different variables, but the two variables that are of most concern to determine the likelihood of bleaching are called hot spots and degree heating leaks. And basically, that's when the oceans reach a threshold when coral bleaching is likely. And for that, that's 30 degrees Celsius or 86 degrees Fahrenheit. And that means that the water is about 1 degree Celsius over the average monthly mean. Mm-hmm. And so it's a function of not only warmer water, but also how long the water has been above average. So it's a function of time as well as how warm the water is. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to do with the Coral Bleaching Alert Network is just make sure that our community and people going out into the water, on the water, are, one, engaged in understanding about what coral bleaching is, and that they, through us, learn more about it and learn how to recognize it. And therefore, two, hopefully they are able to identify it and report to us so that then we can send our monitoring team out to go and do actual scientific surveys and really document the bleaching over the long term, so we can understand which reefs are bleaching, which corals are bleaching, which ones are resilient to bleaching, and get a better understanding over the long term.
Mallory's training and education is as a biologist, and this is a program where we get to geek out. So I'm going to tap that expertise and ask Mallory, for the listenership, just walk through the process to how the warming water results in bleaching of the coral reefs and why that specifically is bad for the coral reef structure.
Okay. So basically, corals are an animal, and they have a plant that lives inside of them. It's called zooxanthellae.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? What's it called, the plant inside called?
It's called zooxanthellae, or we say zoox for short.
Zooxanthellae.
Okay. Zooxanthellae, and it's a symbiotic algae that lives inside the coral, and they benefit each other. So the coral gives the algae a home and protection from predators, otherwise that would eat the algae if it was just floating in the water column. And in turn, the plant uses the sun and uses photosynthesis to create glucose and food, essentially, and energy for the coral. Mm-hmm. But what happens is, as the water heats up, that algae actually can become toxic to the coral, and the coral will eject it out into the water. And so those algae are actually what gives the coral its color. And so when the coral ejects the algae because it's becoming too hot, the water's too hot, and so the algae becomes essentially toxic to the animal, you see the white skeleton underneath the flesh of the coral, and that's why we call it coral bleaching. And so corals can actually survive coral bleaching if the water cools back down and then the algae comes back into the host and lives back in the coral. But if the waters are too warm for too long, the algae will not come back into the coral, and so the coral might actually die and essentially starve to death. And it's important to note that corals are especially vulnerable at this time because about 90% of their energy actually comes from these zooxanthellae that live inside of them. So they're really functioning on low energy here. And if it's too long of a time, and for corals, that's about 8 weeks is the general threshold, they will die. And when they die, then algae will grow on top of them, a different kind of algae, mm-hmm. Will grow on that skeleton. And so when that happens, we really need the herbivores and the fish in the water to eat that algae off the dead coral so that in the future, once conditions calm back down, baby corals can come back and recruit to that reef and continue to grow and continue to perpetuate the reef. So corals are extremely resilient. You know, they've been around literally forever. And so it's not really a matter of how we're going to change them that we can't, that it won't be here anymore, but really what they're going to do with or without it. So what we're asking is that our community works with us to help protect the reefs when they are recovering or when they are undergoing coral bleaching events, like is projected in the next 6 months or so. There's a lot of factors that could change that. So,
like storm systems, for example.
Exactly.
Yeah. I remember you telling me that.
And there's not as much sun, right, or a lot of wind comes in. It can really change the ocean circulation and get that warm water out and flush it out.
I remember you and Whitney Hoot, who is the coral reef coordinator, mentioning that we sort of dodged a bullet earlier this year because a massive onset of warming water that got disrupted by storm systems. And so we sort of dodged that bullet. So.
And actually, NOAA is predicting with 75% confidence that 2020 will be the warmest year on record. They say that every year, of course, because with climate change, we're just getting warmer and warmer. So we are projecting that coral bleaching will be more of a frequent event. And like I said, we really need to be aware of what that is. And so we're trying to get the community to be engaged on this as we go through the coral bleaching season through the Guam Coral Bleaching Alert Network and report to us. So actually, since 2016, we've been having the Eyes on the Reef Marianas program, which trains local community volunteers about coral bleaching and how to recognize it and how to report it. So we've trained over 300 people. So there are people trained, community members and volunteers out in the community. But we're also hoping that, you know, if you get involved with the network, you can learn yourself about how to recognize it, and therefore you'll report to us. So we ask that if you do see coral bleaching, you take photos, you take note of the depth of the location, GPS coordinates, and as much information as you can collect, and send it to us, and we'll go check it out.
And I believe you have the training module for EIR on the website, theguamcoralreefs.com.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. You can just go to our website, guamcoralreefs.com/GCDAN, and the link to all the training modules is there. We've got videos, we've got infographics, and I also really encourage you to follow us on Facebook, because we'll be posting continuous updates on Facebook, and if you like our page, you'll get the updates on your Facebook.
So what's the name of the Facebook page?
The Facebook page is Guam CBAN.
We have a new Facebook page, not just the Coral Reefs Initiative page, but we have a new Facebook page just for Guam CBAN.
Yes, okay. The Guam CBAN Alert Network.
Oh, see, folks, even I learned new stuff here by having Mallory on. Okay. In essence, though, if I could summarize the Guam CBAN approach here, the three main goals of the program. One is to raise awareness, general awareness, of the state of the coral reefs and the ongoing battle to preserve them, given the onset of climate change. And the second one is to also, by raising this awareness as people go out into the waters, to take care during those coral bleaching events and not add to the damage to it, and just be careful with this. And then the third reason is as you alluded to earlier, was to create the system for collecting information and photographs, and so and getting that back into the people like Mallory and Whitney and the people involved in helping protect our coral reefs, and those therefore inform ongoing strategies to help defend the reefs. Does that kind of summarize the general goals of the Guam Coral Reef?
Exactly. That's it. You know, the monitoring team, and there's just a small handful of coral managers on Guam, and we have so many community members going out into the water every day. So as many eyes and ears as we can get on the water, you know, we're open to working with the community and really appreciate your feedback and letting us know if you see something.
And this is of really crucial importance because of issues this large, I mean, like climate change and coral reefs. They're really not challenges or problems that can be resolved by a single government agency or even a single government. That it really involves the community involvement in terms of dealing with the coral reefs. And some of it the involvement also doesn't necessarily involve going to the water. I mean, your colleague Patrick Keeler, for example, works with the Department of Agriculture for a number of their forestry programs in order to deal with erosion, so you don't have the runoff that will contribute to clouding the water and help contribute to coral bleaching. And so that takes in a lot of volunteers. If anyone wants to get involved in direct help with the coral reefs here, I mean, what avenues are available? There's one at UOG that recently got started earlier this year. Collecting certified divers to help with the monitoring and the care of the reefs. And there's ongoing work by the UOG Marine Lab. By the way, if anyone has any questions for Mallory, you can call in to 477-5757, 477-5757. So, in brief, Mallory, how does people get onto the network? Do they go to the website? How do they sign up for this?
Yep. The best way would be through Facebook and going to our page and liking the page, and then you'll receive the updates.
When they go to the Facebook page, they'll say the like, and then they'll receive the what? The sign up?
The update.
The updates. Okay. Yep. So they'll get the information there.
We're making posts periodically, and especially when the alert level change. Mm-hmm. And that way you'll be following the network updates. But also, if you don't have Facebook, you can go to www.guamcoralreef.com/GCBAN, and there's a sign up. You can give us your email address and sign up for the newsletter as well.
Well, how does the process of collecting information and getting back to people like you and Whitney and those working on it, how exactly does that work? Say you're out, you're part of the network, and you're out there and you see a coral bleaching event and mm-hmm. and you have taking notes or taking pictures. What is the process for getting this back into your hands?
So to file a report, to make a report, you can just reach out directly through GCBAN or go to EORMarianas.org and file a quick report. And that information goes to the monitoring programs. So we have a few monitoring programs on island. The reef flat monitoring, these are all through the University of Guam Marine Lab and the Guam Long-Term Monitoring Program. And those, they will then go and do actual surveys in the water through a scientific process that they already have long established. And we need to collect this information over time to really understand the extent of it and how the coral community is changing over time. So that's definitely an important note, is if you see coral bleaching and you report to us, we can't necessarily go out there and fix or stop the bleaching. Mm-hmm. That's just climate change, right? But what we really need and what you can do is help us to research it, document it, and understand it better so that hopefully you can, in the future, make different actions. So, for example, in the future, if we know certain areas are really bleaching more than others, then maybe during the bleaching season, we can think about different actions or requests to protect those corals, specifically in that area, for example. It just goes to the monitoring programs, and we'll go and do actual surveys.
Yes. And so, thanks very much for joining us, Mallory. This is Mallory Morgan, the Sustainable Tourism Coordinator. And sometime in the future, we've already talked about this before, but you'll bring back any update on your activities as Sustainable Tourism Coordinator. And thanks to a relationship with the Guam Visitors Bureau, your desk is at GVB, I believe, nowadays.
I am. I'm sitting at Guam Visitors Bureau, and we're trying to, during this unique opportunity of rest from tourism, we're trying to think about how we can make sure that we bring tourism back with an eye on protecting our resources.
Yeah, which is an entire another program here, and I've already taken up enough of Mallory's time for away from her real life, to call in the program. So, Mallory, thank you so much for calling in, and we'll catch up later then.
Yep, thanks for having me. Thanks so much.
That was Mallory Morgan, the Sustainable Tourism Coordinator under the Coral Reef Initiative Program, which is a grant program, from two sources, one from the Department of Interior and one from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, that is managed by the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. But the grant is administratively supervised by the Department of Agriculture, led by Chelsea Munyabrecht. If anyone wants more information also on not just the Guam C-Band program, but on coral reefs, there is a Guam Coral Reefs Initiative Facebook page from which you can get regular information about coral reefs generally and things related to it. And recently, there were a number of posts about World Mangroves Day. That is actually an important part in dealing with the protection of the coral reefs. And as a matter of fact, the new coral fellow, Carol Lim, as we had on the program a couple of weeks ago, her focus of her research will be on mangroves and seagrasses. And so as that research progresses, we'll make some posts on the Facebook page for it here. As I mentioned earlier, we coming up in future programs, we're going to tackle issues related to the ongoing compact and negotiations. And we'll have Carlotta Lynn Guerrero on, and also to talk about the military buildup with Carlotta and what's ahead for that. We also will have Joe Barra, director of the Bureau of Statistics, director of the Department of Land Management, who works very closely with the Bureau, and to talk about his new federal grant. We also will have Mel Wampat Barra to talk about decolonization issues here. He's executive director of the Commission on Decolonization. And we also, of course, have on the back of the program Bernie Guinness, the Guam Census Office manager, who is deep into the data collection phase right now. And she'll come have on the program to give us another update as to how the census operation is collection office is going here. If they're out there, if you haven't been contacted by the census, you soon will be. I know I was contacted several weeks ago. It doesn't take that long, and it's actually kind of fun. So, I encourage everybody to look for the census enumerator out there in your neighborhood, and they'll join you soon. Coming up next, we're going to have a discussion about another activity of the Bureau's involved in, which is to recently, as a result of the recent CARES Act, Bureau was able to secure $2.9 million in funding in order to help criminal justice agencies and first responders help give them the resources and the equipment and supplies to effectively battle COVID-19. And joining us for the program is Ray Dunca, from the one of the newer employees of the Bureau of Statistics and Plans, and his responsibility is to manage that grant. Ray, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Okay, Ray, thanks for joining the program.
Sure.
By the way, how long have you been with the Bureau at this point? Are you on 1 month by now?
I started on the 20th, so it's only been a few weeks.
Well, that shows how much at home we feel you're at here. It seems like you've been with us for a while. So anyway, just to before we get some of the details from Ray, I'll give the background here. One of the many CARES bills passed by Congress was funding to help law enforcement and criminal justice agencies. It was distributed largely on a formula basis, but the applicants were for designated agencies throughout the states and the territories. Now, some of you ask, how did the Bureau get involved in this sort of thing? Well, among the many grants the Bureau manages out of the Department of Justice are two important criminal justice grants. One is the Burns Grants, which provide support for criminal justice agencies. We need things like data processing and like for common criminal databases and also to help support aspects of their operations. And also the Paul Coverdell Grants, which are basically to aid criminal forensics. And that money is used to support the GPD Crime Lab. Not only in technical support, but also training, and also efforts to help them prepare for a certification for the Crime Lab, which is coming up in the next few weeks. So, when Congress came up with the idea of helping criminal justice agencies, particularly police departments and first responders, they used the system that was for the distribution of Burns Grant funding and Coverdell Grant funding as a way of getting them into the hands of these agencies. And so, as the designated state agency for those programs here, it was presented to the Bureau to apply for it. And through the hard work of Chief Planner Lolian Guerrero and Miller Giza and Sonia Siliong, The Bureau was able to secure this $2.9 million within a week and a half of its announcement. And having acquired the funding was used basically to provide equipment support for first responders and criminal justice agencies. This includes the Department of Corrections, Department of Youth Affairs, peace officers, GPD, etc. And and a number of things were used, the funding, and still being used to fund for the operations. So, Ray.
Yes.
You have probably the spreadsheets in front of you here. Let's start with the ambulances. One of the things that when we examine the future needs in dealing with COVID-19, and then, you recall one of the big concerns here was hospital beds being overwhelmed by future cases. And unfortunately, due to Governor Luliangro's leadership, we've been able to flatten the curve and avoid that outcome.
Right.
However, it still leaves the task of preparing for future outbreaks here. I mean, there's people who readily predict a second wave in the fall. And if you're going to deal with a situation where hospital beds are going to be stressed out, it was very evident that the medical transports to bring people to the hospitals were also going to be stressed out. And Guam's ambulance fleet was pretty much really at the end of its tether in terms of its maintenance and keeping it up here. So under the governor's directions, the Guam Fire Department had went through the procurement for three new ambulances. And having gotten this funding here, we were able to apply for it, the Bureau applied for it, to additional four ambulances. And so the GFD was... is being added to its fleet, seven brand new ambulances. And roughly four of them are already here, three of the ones bought locally and one bought by the Bureau's grant. And they were sorely needed as soon as they arrived and outfitted out. One was quickly put into service because one of the ambulances were down. But there were another three ambulances still to come. They're funded by the federal grant given to the Bureau. And that was going to come in July, but due to manufacturing delays, it was put off until August. And Ray, do you have an update as to, are they on track to bring it in this month? Or?
Yes, I do. The three remaining ambulances are scheduled to be delivered anywhere between mid to late August.
Mm. And then after that, they're getting here. GBD has to get certified and all this other stuff before they put them on the road. GFD, yes. Their procedures for getting them are rather extensive, and so they almost take almost a week just to get the usual certificates. But Chief Dan Stone is very much looking forward to them, and it will kind of come at a better time because the current fleet is really stressed out, and essentially we're almost replacing the entire fleet with brand new ambulances, and so that's going to come at a crucial time. So we should get those ambulances by this month. Then is that the case, Ray?
Yes, that's correct. That has been confirmed.
Okay, fantastic.
Today,
in addition to vehicles for the ambulances for the fire department, also going through the procurement process, there are two command vehicles to support the ambulance fleet. They're going through the current procurement process now, and that may take a while to get here. But the idea behind getting those two command vehicles here, and I had a long discussion with Chief Dan Stone in the early part about this, was to use these vehicles as sort of force multipliers for the chief's brand new ambulance fleet of seven new ambulances. Under the new COVID-19 restrictions here, when an ambulance is done doing a service call, it has to do a complete cleanup, in order to properly sanitize it for the next case here. And for those of you who are familiar as to how the ambulance runs are normally done here, they're a very busy fleet. And quite often, once they leave the fire station and they go on a run to get a patient and take them to a hospital, a call almost comes in at the same time when they drop them off the hospital, and they have to go not back to the fire station, but straight from the hospital to yet another run. Mm-hmm. And by use of these command vehicles, they can bring the sanitation supplies directly to where the ambulances have to be at whichever hospital and do the cleanup there. So that way, instead of making it come back and cleaned up and go back in the field again, they can just do a quick turnaround and go back out for the next run. And so in this way, we sort of maximize the available funding here to actually come with force multipliers for these, so those seven new ambulances are having even greater impact in dealing with serving the healthcare needs of the people. So in addition to vehicles for the fire department, we also got four new vehicles for the police department, did we not?
Yes, we did. We procured four 2020 Mitsubishi Outlander SUVs for the Guam Police Department.
And they'll be used in for patrol purposes. And these came at a good time as also, because the GPD, through their own initiative, had acquired another five vehicles through Boating Safety Federal Funding and other earmarked locally funded. And so last month, there was a presentation at ALIB for the four vehicles produced by or funded by the Bureau through its federal grant, and the five vehicles acquired by GPD. It's for addition of nine new vehicles added to the GPD fleet for patrols and other support services. And so that was a good day and a very impressive day at ALIB, as we saw those nine vehicles. But of course, a lot of the other funding goes for supplies, like and these went to agencies, and not only GPD, but also to Customs and to DYA and to Department of Corrections, and to also it's earmarked to some of it to go to the judicial branch and public defender. But so perhaps Ray, go on the list, and we'll take them one agency at a time. What kind of supplies have they received, and which is earmarked for them at this point?
The PPEs and supplies that have been procured and distributed.
Yeah, let's set the PPEs aside right now and talk about the sanitation masks and also the cleanings and sanitation supplies. Who got those?
So what we've procured and have distributed throughout the agencies, these items include surgical masks, hand sanitizers, gloves, rubbing alcohol, alcohol prep pads, duct tape, non-contact thermometers, safety goggles, sanitary hand wipes, protective face shields, bath towels, buffon caps, and shoe covers.
And as these supplies came, we get them out as quickly as possible. They've gone to, I think, the first agencies to receive them, because they run 24-hour facilities, was the Department of Corrections and the Department of Youth Affairs.
That's correct.
And so far, though, some of the supplies have gone also to GPD and also to Customs. And there are supplies that are already available and right now as of agencies to pick up. So I believe some of the autonomous agencies, police departments are... Oh, they're waiting for. I'm sorry, that's for the PPEs. But basically, there are other supplies available for other agencies as we get them in as quickly as possible. But in addition to these supplies, and I sort of spoke over as Ray was explaining this, is that we've also as part of the funding, and a good part of the, and like half the funding for the grant went to get N95 masks, which is the high-end PPE equipment, for every single law enforcement officer on the island for at least a 60-day supply. So this would not only include Guam Police Department and DOC and Department of Youth Affairs Juvenile Justice Officers, but also Customs Officers, Park Rangers, Conservation Officers, investigators in the Attorney General's Office, and also the police forces for the Guam International Airport and the Port Authority of Guam for those autonomous police forces. Basically, every single law enforcement officer on the island here. So far, we've gotten equipment out to GPD, and believe there's stuff pending for. Did some of the PPEs get out to the customs officers yet?
DOC and customs are pending pickup.
Okay.
But so far, if I may just explain here, that we've already distributed to GPD as of July 15 and August 3rd, 860 pieces of the N95 masks, 120 has been distributed to DYA, 1,080 to DOC, and 320 to the airport police.
Okay, so they've picked them up already.
Yes.
Is there stuff we're waiting for the port police at this point?
We continue to work out the allotments in the office, and then we will be contacting the other agencies for pickup.
Okay. Well, this, part of the challenge here is that although we've set aside the funding for it here, there have been a number of choke points of the manufacturing there, and there's like a, there's a nationwide shortage of these N95 masks, isn't there, Ray?
Yes, yes, there is.
And so how has that impacted our ability to utilize this funding to actually buy the stuff and get it to the first responders?
Well, we continue to with the process, and we hope that we're able to continue to bring them in. Now, you know, it's just a matter of the very simple supply and demand, and the U.S. companies at this point are not manufacturing them quick enough to meet the demands of these particular masks. But we're doing our best to certainly get our procurement process going, and we continue to work that system. And at this point, we've not, knock on wood, we haven't experienced any delays or any hiccups with our procurement. So we're hopeful that we can continue, in spite of the shortage and demand nationwide, that we will be receiving more.
Well, fortunately, we're in a period where, for the moment, we've been able to contain the COVID-19. I mean, can you imagine having to deal with this challenge of getting these N95 masks and being in Florida or Texas?
Right. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You know. So, but part and parcel as to why we're moving aggressively in these investments in supplies and personal protective equipment for our law enforcement officers and first responders is because it's also to build resiliency in the system. So that if, for example, there is a second wave that we have to deal with here, we don't have to go scramble around like we did in March just to find every all the supplies we needed here.
We would already have them.
They'll be in the It'll be in the hands of our first responders and law enforcement officers, and this thing with the COVID-19. Although Guam is actually doing pretty good, when you compare it to other places in the country, like Arizona and Georgia. And actually, I was watching the news. There's a sharp uptick in areas that are thought to be safe, like the Midwest, and the numbers are it almost seems to be rampaging out of control. Part of it has to do with part of the leadership that's applied to not only the federal level, but in the level of many of these states. They've not had the beneficiary of having a governor who is a registered nurse with a master's in public health. And the determination to do what's right to protect her people, regardless of the short-term criticism or frustrations that she gets from people, she made the tough calls and made the hard decisions. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, time has proven the wisdom of her approach, particularly as we take a look at supposedly better led or more developed communities in the states like Georgia and Florida, which seem to be devolving in some degree if not trouble, perhaps even chaos. But given that, the governor though understands though this is an ongoing struggle. You know, we're not entirely out of the woods. And if you take a look at the outlook, we're probably with COVID-19 for a year. I mean, even if, for example, you get a vaccine like sometime in October, which some people speculated there's a big push to do that for political reasons. But even if you get let's say you get a reasonable vaccine in October, there's going to be a long lead time in the manufacturing process to manufacture the doses for a nation of 300 million people, and to probably distribute it and to get it out there. And even at that, there may be resistance. I mean, I've always been appalled over recent years, all this concerns against vaccinations.
Right.
You know, so Ray, you can imagine what this is going to be like. When we try to persuade people who have filled with some propaganda about vaccinations that they resist that process here. I mean, maybe they'll turn to that so-called doctor who who oxychlorine or moxichlorine here that Trump is doing. Yeah. You know, the woman who predicted people are getting disturbances from demon semen. You know, because sex at night with demons, and also that there's alien DNA that's involved in some medicines. I mean, crazy people like that.
So yes, absolutely.
Who knows how that's going to turn out? But in any event, our job, and actually it's Ray's jobs here. He's the planner been assigned to manage this grant. I should tell you that, and this probably explains how the Bureau's approach to this. You know, although they were full on board to get it, and indeed our federal partners help pave the way to secure this federal funding. Is that there's a lot of hassle involved in this stuff. I mean, even that week we were working to hustle the grant out here. You had to do consultation with stakeholders like GPD and GFD to find out what their needs are and sort of balance it out. Then you have to write the grant according to federal guidelines here. And there are a lot of emails back and forth between Lola Ingram and her team and the Department of Justice. Just to clarify stuff, there have been, there was at least three major nationwide conference calls between the state agencies involving administering Department of Justice grants just to move this process along and to answer people's questions. But I will say the Department of Justice people were exemplary in helping move the process along. One of the things they did to help quick responses is that usually when you apply for their applications come for these grants, the agency receiving a federal agency waits till all the grants come in, and then it starts issuing the approvals there. Well, in this one, they didn't wait for all the grants to come in. If your grant came in, they'll start acting on it as soon as it came in, and that certainly served moving this along. Now, after you get the grant, the money comes in, and then the real pain starts. And you know, normally for these Department of Justice grants, the approach the Bureau has taken, like with the Burns grants and the Coveto grants and the residential treatment facility grants, which goes to Department of Corrections, and also another grant, what's called the Implementation of the Prison Rape Elimination Act. It's mostly concerned with DOC and DOA, and it's their training programs and awareness programs to help rebuild structures to prevent prison rape, which is a major problem across the country. The way these grants are normally done is that the Bureau receives the grants, and then we subaward it to these agencies to do so here. In the case of this CARES Act funding here, we sort of skipped that process for two reasons. Number one is, if you recall the time of the grant, which is like March or April here, most of GovGuam was shut down. And to subaward a grant from one agency to the next, you have to circulate this document, which gets, you know, BBMR signature and DOA signatures and the Attorney General signatures and the Governor's signature. And it takes a god-awful time long under normal stances to get that sort of thing circulated. And we can take a look and say, and we're going to try and do this when most of GovGuam is shut down. Maybe not. So we skipped over the whole idea of subawarding the grant and assumed the responsibility for doing all this procurement. And Sonia Sellyong, and now aided by Ray, has done the major responsibility for actually buying the ambulances and the supplies and the PPEs and the police vehicles here. We assumed the Bureau assumed responsibility for procuring all this stuff and utilizing the grants. Now, obviously, we did in close consultation with these agencies, so we got the stuff that they wanted.
Right.
But also, the other second reason why we took this approach here was that even on the best of circumstances, the sort of administrative cadre that particularly line agencies, the GPD and GOC and DOA, these guys are really worked very hard and have an enormous burden to do so. And so we figured, given that the first responder agencies had so much on their table, we at the Bureau said, well, tell you what, we'll deal with that administrative burden. We'll deal with the hassles of doing the purchase orders and all the other stuff here and just get to the stuff as quickly as possible. And so as a consequence, a lot of the paperwork in terms of managing the grant falling on the Bureau and on Ray specifically, folks. So over the next year, he's going to file an interminable number of mind-numbing reports to the Department of Justice just to fulfill their reporting requirements here. But that's the sort of hassle that comes in when you get these grants. I mean, it's great when the checks come in, but there's an awful lot of paperwork attached to federal grants. And
absolutely.
Yeah, as you're finding out in your first few weeks, you know, you're welcome.
Yeah.
There is, then again, there is also a degree of rewarding to be able to pitch in a time of crisis, and maximize resources. Ray, those are your thoughts about it too, as well, right, Ray?
Oh yes, absolutely. It's a lot of work, but it's work that's well worth it all.
And particularly in this case, we get to see the real real world effects of it here, and particularly that happens in the Bureau of Statistics and Plans, because as all these supplies come in for personal protective equipment and sanitation supplies and cleaning supplies, they're piled up in the Bureau's offices. You know, the agency looks now like a warehouse, because they're kind of stacked to the ceilings and people are like working around them as they come in as a temporary staging area for the agencies to come by and pick it up, and they come by in their trucks. And for anyone interested in that, we have pictures of that posted on the Bureau's Facebook pages see how that process is. So anyway, Ray, in addition to the PPE's equipment, we also believe some specialized equipment came in. Some of the specialized service we did was also getting a nurse for the Department of Youth Affairs to help them with intake during the height of the COVID-19 crisis, you know, because they run a 24-hour facility. And so what we did there was the Bureau, we worked with the Director of Youth Affairs, Lonnie Brennan, who selected the nurse, and the Bureau actually hired him, and then we sent him up to the to DYA to work. And so there's that effort, but also there's other specialized stuff that's coming in. Like, for believe, there's some portable wash basins for the GPD.
Yes, there's those, and there's also biohazard containers, mm-hmm. or trash cans, biohazard trash bags, hand sanitizer, touchless dispensers.
What's a touchless dispenser?
A hand sanitizer.
Oh, touchless dispenser. Touchless dispenser. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Great. You know, some of that is to help them with GPD and their field work as well. In addition, we've also supported emergency signage from the Department of Public Works with this grant. It's a small percentage of it, and in the process of doing all this procurement, I think I need to mention that not only credit Sonia Siliong from the Bureau here, but also the people at Civil Defense very early on while they had emergency procurement authority here. Sonia worked with them to actually procure things like the ambulances and the police vehicles. And just as a sort of explanation as to how this sort of system works, although Civil Defense had the emergency procurement there, they generally relied upon agencies doing the purchasing, like the Bureau, to do the legwork, to go out and get the quotes and get the paper for the purchase orders and all this other stuff. So Sonia put in many, many, many hours just to move the stuff along and acquire as much as we could as quickly as possible. And in no small part due to her work here. This is why barely a couple months later after we got the grant, we were able to get new police vehicles, one of four ambulances, and the remainder, if it arrives on schedule, will arrive this month, and there will quickly be put into service. I know the four vehicles, the Mitsubishis that came in, have already been put into service by the Guam Police Department. And this, like I said, the major hangup right now is basically the N95 mask. Isn't that the case, Ray?
Yes, it is.
That's the real hassle. But considering what's happening nationwide, it's probably not entirely surprising. But our goal is to get this stuff procured as quickly as possible. And so if there is, not only for current use, but also if there is a second wave or there's something else goes wrong across the next year, we're prepared. Mm-hmm. That one of the things we determined early on, because particularly in the early days of the emergency, we didn't, the projections were that if we didn't flatten the curve, we would have a major problem with with hospitalization beds and outbreaks in the community here. There was worldwide concern. And And also, and it kind of like from our perspective, Ray, I mean, doesn't it look like it feels like it's stabilized? And then we watch the news and see what's happening in Georgia. And we go, well, you know, and it's almost like it's on a different planet. But some of that urgency, even though we knew it would take a while, to say, was not just to help prepare for what was going to maybe an immediate crisis, but to prepare for the long term. So when that wave comes, we don't have to go scramble around. Well, listen, Ray, we're now in the final few minutes of the program. Is there this is your chance, because I've done, too much of the talking. Anything else you want to add on regarding the Bureau's efforts in applying this CARES Act money?
I think you did a very wonderful job in covering all the necessary and important details of the program. But I did want to mention that the, as you mentioned early on, that the grant award was for $2.9 million. Our actual expenditures, although it seems small to that amount of $103,000, so that amount plus our outstanding encumbrances comes to $1.3 million.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
we're
the reason is for that, folks, is that half of that. Of the funding for the grant was for the PPEs.
Our balance to date is $1.6 million.
Yeah. Half of that amount is the PPEs, and it's difficult to spend that money because we haven't been able to find enough manufacturers to fulfill the entire order.
Right.
But the rest of it has been, like in the ambulances and then the supplies and stuff, that has been maxed out as much as we can. I'm sorry, I interrupt you, Ray. Continue.
No, I just wanted to make sure that we get those numbers out because, the grant was only received in April, and it's only August now, and we've done a great job in trying to get the, you know, what we need procured very proactively, daily, getting information out, quotes in, so that we can continue our efforts in procuring. And as you said, we want to be prepared should there be a second wave. We don't want to be caught with our, you know, pants down, so to speak.
No.
We certainly want to be prepared.
Yeah,
and I have to say that the agencies that have come in to pick up their supplies, they have just been expressing so much gratitude for the efforts that the Bureau has taken to be able to supply them with these very, very much needed supplies.
But I also, I think they appreciate the teamwork involved in this.
Absolutely. The most they have to do is come down with some manpower and a vehicle to pick up. And as I said,
they leave it to you to file the reports for the next year with the Department of Justice. So yeah. But you know, actually, that is sort of the instruction that me and my fellow cabinet officers and the administration received from Governor Leon Guerrero, which was to work together to solve problems, because money is tight and resources are limited here, and we have to be creative to leverage as much as possible. To do our jobs and provide improved service and for the people of Guam. So, Ray, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm going to have you on again, you know, as we continue to get more stuff in to keep people updated as to what's happening in the grant. So we're coming up against the 7-0 lose. I was Ray Duncan from the Bureau of Statistics and Plans. I'm Tyrone Titano. This has been the Data Hub with Tyrone Titano. Every Tuesday night. See you next week. Now up the news.